Yeah.
Thank you.
No, so basically what I wanted to do very quickly is to go over some things that we have been doing which are moving in the direction of trying to understand shear jamming. But the first disclaimer is that, in fact, I'm not going to be presenting any results that are explicitly shear jamming results. But I think this sort of offers a way of understanding shear jamming. There are lots of open questions, and many people here have been thinking about these for a much longer time than I have. We actually sort of stumbled on this problem because of something else we were thinking about. So I'll briefly sort of set up how we got into this, and then I'll tell you what we find, and I'll sort of, as I go along, mention what are not clear and what seems to be clear and interesting. Okay, so this is a quick outline. So what we started with was looking at free volume distributions in sphere, in hard sphere systems, and there's something interesting there I'll share with you, and which is basically a characteristic signature of being close to the jamming point. Okay, so we've then been sort of trying to understand where that comes from, but also to ask, if I didn't sort of look at the canonical isotropic jamming situation, sort of equal size spheres, close to 64%, under some well-established protocol, but if I were to sort of look at sphere packings in other situations, how does this geometric feature behave, and does it tell us in some meaningful way whether we're close to the jamming point? Okay, and so one of the things that we have been looking at in this spirit has been sheared configurations of soft spheres, and that's what I want to tell you about. Okay, so just to set up the language, so this is where we start. If you look for simplicity at a configuration of hard spheres, which are of this size, and you ask, what is the space available to one of these spheres, which is the red sphere that's marked here? Is there some other way to point, which I'm... I like this better. So if I ask, what is the volume available for this sphere without all these other guys moving around, then the center of the sphere can probe the shaded blue area, and that's called the free volume. Okay.
The spheres are the black or the white objects?
The sphere, so the white objects are the exclusion spheres, meaning the center of this guy cannot come any closer to this guy than this point. Okay? So if I had two spheres at contact, if this sphere were to be in contact with this guy, its center will be here. It's twice the radius.
The white region is just how close the center can come. If the center is there, inside that, it'll overlap.
Everybody has a lot of space.
Sorry?
Everybody now has a lot of space.
Yeah, this is a fairly, it's an illustration, but okay. To calculate the free volumes, therefore, you have to sort of analyze the void space in arbitrary sphere packings, which we know how to do, and we've been using that as I'll skip this. I won't to look at hard sphere fluids and jam configurations. So this is sort of the initial point of this discussion. So if I look at the free volume distribution of a hard sphere fluid over a range of packing fractions, this is sort of
This is 3D
monodisperse here, but we've also looked in the past at polydisperse spheres, and that's sort of qualitatively similar behavior. So going from sort of a low end of the dense region to fairly large densities, but still, these are all fluid configurations. You find sort of a generic form for the free volume distribution, where as I decrease the density, the mean free volume is predictably coming down. Okay, and so at some point we said, how will this distribution look if I were to actually look at configurations which are very close to the jamming point? Strictly at the jamming point, strictly speaking, the free volumes are all zero because every sphere has other spheres that are in contact.
Except for the ones that have free volume.
Except for the ones that have free volume, yes. They're all on the same wavelength here. But
these
rattlers, right? But okay, I'm just sort of mentioning that to sidestep that issue. Basically, you do have rattlers, but also what we're going to ask is, if I were to be infinitesimally away from the jamming, strict jamming points, that every sphere in principle has free volume, how does the distribution look, right? And so we looked at this. Yeah.
Just from knowing the weight in the depth of peak of a no free volume, you would not know whether you look at the jam situation.
Say that again.
You said in a jam situation, there's the finest fraction possible that has zero free volume. But just by telling me what fraction zero free volume,
Most have zero free volume. So the sort of in mono, in equal size sphere packings. Typical protocols of generating jam structures get you about 2% of particles which are rattlers, 2% or less, and these will have finite free volume. Okay, but the rest 98% of the system, which form a percolating contact network, in the strict jamming point will have zero free volume. Okay, but this is now the distribution that we get when we sit at a density which is very close to the jamming point. And this was a surprise, because if I take this liquid-like free volume distribution and say my mean free volume is getting smaller and smaller, I might have expected something here, right? But what you find is, in addition to a small free volume feature, a power law distribution of free volumes, okay? And we've sort of spent some time, and this is if you look carefully at the axes, even though this is only a part of the distribution, it extends over something like
eight
decades.
Do you need large systems?
Right? What?
Do you need large systems?
No. So this cutoff is not a matter of system size. It's a cutoff because you do have neighbors that limit how far this can go. Now, what will happen is that if you were to look at scaled free volumes, if you go arbitrarily close to the jamming point, those scaled free volumes with respect to the mean will extend, this power law tail will extend to infinity. Okay, so this is now, from previous work than what I'm describing today, a background for us to say, okay, here is a signature of being close to the jamming point, right? And we, like I said, started to ask, how does this free volume distribution look in a variety of contexts? What happens if we look at systems which have pinning, and systems which have attractive interactions, and systems where we take sphere configurations and we shear them, okay? And the last is the story that I want to tell. And we weren't at all thinking about the shear jamming phase diagram and so on, though I'd heard Bulbul talk about it sometimes. I was aware of this, but Bulbul also talked about this a couple of weeks ago. And so here is sort of sketches of the two-dimensional phase diagram of sheared sphere packings, where if you have frictionless spheres, you have a boundary between the jammed and the unjammed, like so. But if you have, in this work, which is mentioned here, there's been sort of an analysis of what happens when you do have friction. And the idea is that there is a range of densities below sort of these frictionless isotropic jamming point where you can get jamming, okay? Now, so what I'm going to do for the rest of the 10 or whatever minutes is to sort of present work where we look at monodisperse sphere packings, and not to be perverse, but because of where we started, these are going to be frictionless spheres, even though at the end I'm going to try and make a connection to frictional packings. Okay, so we're going to compress either from the fluid at a packing fraction of 45% or decompress from jammed packings at 64% to any desired density. And so this is, by doing this, we generate an ensemble of configurations over a wide range of densities from, you know, we look at from 0.5 to nearly 0.64. And now this, these set of configurations at a range of densities, we subject to an athermal quasi-static strain, which in this particular context is probably the right thing to do. We're basically looking at particles that when you shear them don't move other than in response to the force you apply. In fact, energy is not, these are soft spheres, but particles by and large don't overlap. Anyway, so I'll mention those details later on. But we apply strain and we generate configurations that evolve accordingly. And what we do first is to analyze the geometry. We look at the force network, force distributions, and vibrational modes in that sequence. And the upshot of what we find is that the structure of these shear configurations evolves to look like jammed packings, even though for the range of densities one is considering, there is no jamming for frictionless spheres. But like the case of the shear jamming in the presence of friction, we do identify a threshold density above which the behavior of these systems changes. And I will argue that friction in this range may stabilize the sheared configurations we generate. And this is sort of a way of trying to understand the separate roles, if you will, that geometry plays, which is induced by the shearing that you do, and friction might in generating shear jammed configurations.
When you say steady state,
yeah, I'll
mean just.
Yeah, I'll illustrate. Yeah.
But
so,
can I ask another question? But on the other hand, this is what you would expect, right? I mean, if you see that when there is friction, you get solid states at lower body fraction.
Right? Yeah. So, right. No, but I'm saying.
That's not the same. Like, you're talking about random loose packing. Mm-hmm. That's not the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, may or may not be, but okay.
That might be the limit, but I'm saying the shear jams. Yeah. Yeah, could be.
But
yeah.
People have the
striker called yeah. Right. Yeah. So, okay. So what are the quantities we look at? We look at the GFR. We look at the distribution of contact numbers. And this is now at one density, 0.58, which is sort of on the lower side of the densities we look at. And this is now looking at what happens as you go through different values of the strain. And the last curve is the sort of a reference curve at the jamming point. And what you see is that this contact number distribution, or yeah, the distribution of the number of contacts starts out mostly being, yeah, sorry. Right, okay. I'll have to figure out how to reach there, but I'll then move to that side. Okay. So what you find is that as you increase the strain, this distribution moves to the right, becomes peaked at a finite value of the number of contacts, and sort of, you know, looks like it's headed towards the jamming distribution of contacts. But it doesn't get there for this density. Okay.
So are you using energy minimization?
Yeah.
So I have an issue.
Okay.
So when you do energy minimization without shear, you don't get any contacts because.
Yeah.
You don't have a steady state. So are you saying that there's now a plethora of mechanically stable states at those strains? Do you see what I'm saying? So the question is, so either the contact number should be 6.
Right.
Or it should be 0.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm saying, it's a hypothesis for if it's very similar to isotropic compression, is for isotropic compression, you either have a state that's not mechanically stable with 0 contacts because you're doing energy minimization, all the particles move away, or you have 6 contacts.
Okay, so what we're doing is obviously not energy minimization under isotropic conditions, but we're looking at configurations that are sheared and minimized as you shear them, which is the AQS procedure.
Right, but no one's seen packing stabilized at 3 or 4 contacts.
Okay,
are just there because you don't have inertia, because the particles are not.
Right. Right. No, so as I said in the beginning, because you're looking at possibly modeling granular systems, if you imagine what you might be doing if you take a granular suspension and shearing it, this, I would say, is the right way to do it. Okay? These are systems.
You're still minimizing the energy to begin with, are you?
Right.
So where is the energy? Because you're dealing with a granular system with no intrinsic energy.
Well, here. I mean, these are soft
spheres. Just a soft sphere potential system, frictionless.
Soft sphere systems, yeah. Okay.
No, but the contention is if you kept running your energy minimization, would those contacts persist, or would they go to 0 contact? So run your energy minimization for another year.
Yeah. No, so I'll
So how do you determine whether a vacuum is stable or not?
We'll come to this. Okay, I'm not saying any of that yet.
Said anything about,
but that's what I want to go towards. Okay. Now when we look at the GFR, there are sort of two characteristic features of the GFR. One is a near contact singularity, and the other is the singularity is at the split second peak. Again, the purple curve is the reference at that jamming. But what you see is that starting with this fluid-like GFR, as you increase the strain, you're developing the features that you expect for jammed configurations. Lastly,
density correlation.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Pair correlation.
Yeah.
Pair correlation.
Well, it is.
If I have a particle here, what's the probability of finding something?
Yeah. Okay. Now, this is now looking at what happens to the GFR at contact or close to contact. You start out with this distribution, which has no singular behavior as you go towards the contact value. But you see how, as you strain it, it develops towards this magenta curve, which is very similar to what you have at the jamming point. Okay. And the free volume distribution, similarly, start out looking liquid-like. And as you strain, it's developing features that are very similar to jam, nearly jam configurations.
So I think you obviously know my bias. My bias is that if you have a jammed configuration, you have to have that peak, because the particles need to know that they're in contact. Mm-hmm. And so what you're seeing is just a very wide distribution of separations, and so the particles don't know whether they're supposed to be in contact or not.
Huh? I don't understand.
Okay, what I'm saying is that I think his results are very sensitive to how long he runs his energy minimization. So he said, I'm going to run my energy minimization, I'm just being facetious, I'm going to run my energy minimization for 2 hours. And so for the zero strain, that was enough. And so the particles that are supposed to be in contact are at contact, and you have this large peak. But for the ones that with strain, it takes a much longer time for the particles to move and figure out who's supposed to be in contact and who's not.
But some did contact.
No. So
the question that the particles need to figure out is whether they're supposed to be in contact or not, and is there enough room for everybody to move out of contact? My contention is that the system did not figure out that everybody is not supposed to be in contact.
Yeah, I think the problem is that
The system has to be mechanically stable. I mean,
well, that's
mechanical stability is what I'm getting to at the end. All I'm doing right now.
But then there should be no contacts, because the particles can move.
Yes.
This is what I find.
No, but run it, run it for, seriously, run it for 2 more weeks. I've done it, sorry.
But sorry, isn't the answer that your configurations are all at zero energy, and they are at the boundary of a zero energy plane, and when you move away from this boundary, the contact number and all your orbit changes.
But can't you just run the energy minimization for longer?
But if it's zero, if the energy.
Yeah, but if you get to zero energies.
So, no, you're not at zero energy.
There are two energies.
No,
sorry, kinetic energy is potential energy.
No, no, no. So, no, so there is no kinetic energy in this.
Okay, so kinetic energy.
So the system basically, yeah, moves downhill till you reach the local energy minimum.
Okay, so where's your potential energy?
Well, these are soft spheres with harmonic interactions.
Yes. So do you have potential energy all over?
You mean in general?
No, just asking these states, what energy are
there? So the answer is, okay, I don't have those slides because I sort of have some.
But approximately.
But basically, you have very, very small stresses and energies.
10 to the power minus 13?
10 to the minus 14, 15.
Okay, that's numerical accuracy. So what you practically have is the spheres touching.
No, that's not numerical accuracy.
Well, yeah, it's no, no. So it is finite, but you know, if you look at GFR, maybe we should. I mean, I'll say a little bit, but we can.
But one obviously question: these are all at that same energy. Right?
See, if you look at where this feature comes from,
zero
right?
Energy.
This is coming from very specific local geometries. These are sort of edge-sharing triangles, and it's quite conceivable that these will have finite energies at the minimum, right?
The key result would be, we know that the energies are going to be very small. So saying it's 10 to the minus 10 or 10 to the minus 15 is
right.
Irrelevant.
Right.
What you really have to show is that it's as you vary by orders and orders and orders of magnitude that the contact number doesn't change. And my bet is that if you change the lowest energy that you emit by 3 or 4 orders of magnitude, those curves will shift to lower and lower z. Now, that may be irrelevant,
right.
Because what's really important is that while the particles change by some very small amount, but the features, I'm just saying maybe the contact number is not the right variable. It's really in the Voronoi volumes or something.
But you're looking at free volumes.
No, but he's showing
yeah,
the
these are contact
numbers. And GFR and free volume.
Right. This slide is very sensitive on its threshold. And it doesn't matter that you say the energy is 10 to the minus 10. I know it's a small number.
Okay.
But look at 10 to the minus 30. I mean, it depends exactly on what you define as contact.
Okay, but can I ask a separate question? So all of these things are at the same energy threshold, right? What do you call zero? And is it interesting to ask that as a function of strain, the geometry is changing if I look at all of the minima at that energy?
Right.
That's basically what he's going
to do. So, you know, I should get through to the end, and then we can discuss, right? Because of
this,
yeah.
Specify your interaction potential. So for R bigger than C,
right.
It's zero.
So it's zero for R bigger than zero.
Yeah, but then the energy can be exactly zero, no?
Yeah.
And it is exactly zero in an infinite manifold, no? So you're
sure.
What Corey is asking. He has configurations that have exactly zero energy, and there are millions of such configurations.
Sure.
They are all not mechanically stable. It's just stopping as soon as he reaches the border of the zero energy.
Yeah.
Anymore.
Yeah.
And that's why there are contacts, because he's not moving on. But if he moved on with some inertia, then.
So the contact number distributions that he shows are arbitrary.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. That's what I'm saying.
He's holding the volume.
Okay, so.
He's holding the volume.
Okay, so, no. Right. So what you find. Okay.
Yes, he can. He's at 58%. They can find room.
Sorry.
Okay, so this precision issue. Yeah. So In the graphs that I showed, we use a cutoff where the GFR deviates from the power law. Okay, that's the contact number I'm showing. And it's arbitrary for the sake of this presentation, but it's precise and arbitrary, right? But we can talk about what happens if you move that around, yeah? But there is, by looking at the GFR, there is a way to define a meaningful threshold where you say below that it's contact and above that it's not, yeah? So now here is how the contact numbers vary as you increase the strain. They're all increasing, going to a plateau, happens quicker at higher densities and later at lower densities. The number of rattlers, which are particles which have, by whatever definition I'm using, less than 4 contacts, drops as I go to, initially everybody is a rattler because in the fluid configurations you have no contacts. But as you increase the strain, this is dropping, and it's dropping to different values depending on the density, higher as I go to lower densities.
Okay. The
number of rattlers are higher at lower densities, right? And these are now the steady state distributions of contact number, GFR. Okay, I'll just rush through this and we can come back.
It's where it's reached the plateau.
this is now for all the densities. You see over this range, this power law, which is roughly the same for all the different cases. The free volume distributions also exhibit a power law tail, as in the jammed case. With somewhat slightly different power law exponents, which we don't understand at the moment. Okay, so now, this is just for structure. So this is how the geometry is evolving, right? Frictionless soft spheres subjected to shear. Now, we then ask, what else is happening? So one thing that's sort of an obvious thing to look at is the contact network, right? And we look at the percolation probability of the contact network as a function of the density. And we find that there's a percolation transition around about 57%. Okay.
This is, again, looking at some strain at which things have reached this plateau.
Exactly, yeah. Once we've reached the plateau, we look at the yeah.
For one system size. So as a function of
your GFR. Okay, right, fine. But now here is something that's a little bit non-obvious. The force distribution. Just to say it, at all these densities, the system is not really jammed, okay? But if you look at the force distribution, you find that above about 57%, you develop a finite force peak, like what you see for jammed configurations. And I'll say a little bit more about it, but before that, I thought I'll show, if I can, what happened? Too bad. Well, this was, maybe I'll show it later. But that sort of shows how, as you strain, the percolation network develops. It's nice. But now, here is something that I would like to understand better. If you try and calculate the force exponent, the exponent that corresponds to the initial rise of the force distribution for all these densities, right? It's a little bit, it looks like there isn't a single power law that describes that initial increase. So depending on how you look, you actually get fairly significantly different exponents. This one and this one. The GFR exponent is roughly 0.45.
Okay. Can you remind us the definition of this exponent?
Which one? Basically, P of F is supposed to go as some f to the theta, okay? And this is the exponent, the initial rise, okay? It doesn't quite behave like that, like I said, but I can look at the initial part and ask what is the power of the power law that I see. And the interesting thing is, there's sort of different stability criteria, two different sets of values to look at, but at least for some of these cases, the stability condition is satisfied, okay? Even if I look at the smaller of the exponents. But
the one at 0.627 is the isotropic jamming?
Sorry?
The last one is the isotropic jamming exponent, so?
Which one now? Which
0.627, the last five.
Right, so here, so basically, okay.
Just remind me what the ones are for isotropic packing.
It's 0.64.
No, the exponent.
Exponent. Offhand, I don't know, but you need it to be bigger than 0.22 if the g of r exponent is 0.45, right? So, so now the last thing of this set, I'm sorry about this, but if I now look at the density that I'm looking at and the corresponding coordination number in the steady state, what I find is the black data points, and they sort of sit pretty cozily between a theoretical estimate of this parametric relationship between the jamming density and the coordination number for frictional spheres. Okay, so this is from Leo Silbert's simulations. This is Marxe and company's sort of theoretical expression, where this is supposed to be the zero friction end and the infinite friction end, and our data basically goes right along with those results. Okay, so the question is, what's the relation? Because what we're looking at are shared frictionless spheres, right? But these are predictions for, this is a prediction for frictional jammed spheres, right? So one thing to sort of clear up is what is going to happen if we take our configurations and try to jam them, right? So we use the Lubachevsky-Strelinger procedure to do it.
Which creates isotropic jammed spheres?
Sorry?
Which creates isotropic jam
states? Okay, so let me just quickly say what we find. So in Lubachevsky-Strelinger, you can vary the rate at which you compress them. And if we do it slow enough, we basically go to the 64%, right? But we find something funny at the highest compression rate, which is that above a certain density, when I compress, I basically stay where I am. Right, but as I go to lower densities, I begin to sort of move towards higher densities as a result of the compression protocol. Right, so there is sort of a threshold, apparently, above which the behavior changes, and this so happens to be also the threshold above which I had a percolation of the force network. Okay, so
have you done the soft compression?
Well, that was sort of what led us to this, because initially we were just sort of doing this and we were finding this behavior and we were pretty happy. And then I told my student to do the minimization, and she found, and I said, what's going on? Why do you have these completely different results? So we then sort of went and looked at different compression rates, and we're still doing it, but this is good enough to tell you what's happening, right? Okay, so here's a situation where you're taking frictionless spheres, you're sort of shearing them at densities where frictionless spheres do not jam, but you have, by a number of different measures, an indication that they look jammed, okay? And so one sort of picture that we're sort of exploring is that you can think of what happens when you do shear jamming, as you know, the experiments and corresponding simulations, as sort of a process where there are two players. One is the act of shearing itself, and its role is to generate a certain geometry. And then there is the role of the friction, which is to stabilize what you generate or not. Okay? Now, is this picture true? And so we test that by taking the configurations that we generate and we add to this normal force something that mimics friction, which is basically a transverse spring. So whenever I have two spheres in contact, I add a harmonic spring with respect to transverse displacements. Okay, and I ask what happens then to these configurations. And this is shown here. In order to ask that question, we do a normal mode analysis, which allows us to count how many soft modes I have. And if without sort of the transverse potential, if you look at the different densities going from 0.58 to 0.67, if you look at the value on the x-axis of the cumulative distribution of frequencies, this is basically the fraction of soft modes, right? It's sort of about two-thirds of the modes at 0.58, and it's gone down to about 10% at 0.627, but there is a finite fraction of soft modes, yeah?
And these are without friction?
Without friction. When I add this interaction that mimics friction, what I find is that, so if I look at the highest density, the fraction of modes that is unstable basically drops to zero, right? So I was very happy to see this. Then we ask the next obvious question, which is what happens as I go to lower and lower densities? And what you find is that as you go to lower densities, certainly a lot of modes become stabilized, but not all of them, right? And this gap becomes bigger and bigger as you go to lower densities. So we plot here the fraction of stable modes as a function of density for all the spheres without friction or without transverse stiffness, looking only at the non-rattlers, just to be clear. And this is now adding this transverse interaction. Okay, let me just finish. This is the last bit. Yeah. So what we find is that this fraction of stable modes, which is going to one as I go to the 64% limit, basically goes to zero at the point where I see the percolation of the contact network, the development of a finite force peak in the force distribution, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So this seems like a nice picture where you understand what friction may be doing and what shear may be doing in generating shear jamming. Okay, I'll stop.
Can you
just
repeat what friction modeling
you use? Just, so we just add, I don't know. Well, this is, we're not really doing friction, right? I mean, so this is just.
It's just a tangential spring.
It's a tangential spring. Whenever I have a contact, so if I have.
That's all. This is static friction. There's no viscosity here. There's just constant. It's just contact. The contact laws have now a tangential force.
But not it's not true friction.
It's not true friction.
It's not proportional to the normal force in any way.
Yeah.
So if you. So I love all this stuff coming together, but I think I have a problem. What if you just did compression? So I start at a low packing fraction, I compress,
In fact, I've actually done the simulation.
Yeah.
So you compress and then you remove energy the way you did, you remove energy the way you did. Right. And then you have some threshold, just like everybody's saying, I'm going to look at all the states that are at a certain energy. You get the exact same results, that if you don't remove all the energy, you'll have some set of contacts. And if you have the threshold fairly high, you know, you'll start getting percolating states at very low packet fractions. So I guess the basic question is, what is so special about shear? I mean, I think shear is special, but I would get very similar results if I just did compression. So I compress the system in 3D around 57, 58%.
Well,
I'll have things light up, and then they'll slowly, the forces will slowly settle down.
Well, aren't you changing the density as a result?
No, I'm saying that I'm just...
He picks your final density and shoots for that, and then lets it relax.
Yeah, I'm just saying, suppose the particles are small. I have some box.
Right.
The particles are small. I inflate the particles, so I'm at slightly higher density. I inflate the particles, slightly higher density. Mm-hmm. And then eventually at 58% of the box, the force chains will light up, just like you say. And then they'll slowly decay.
What's the strain dependence here? What's the strain doing? Jim
doesn't understand, so what's going on?
I think he has the same question.
That's not unusual. You're removing the energy. I have the impression that what you're doing, or what he's doing, is he's moving these particles around so they get out of interaction.
Okay, I can do that as well.
Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying I'm moving them around, but they're small initially, and then they're large. I'm slowly growing them.
You do the inflation gap.
I'm doing the inflation gap.
But then you're changing the volume pressure.
Yeah.
So,
and then you stop.
So, I mean, I'm going to start small, and the key point that I'm saying is that 58%, there's going to be an extensive network of force chains.
No, but if...
Which are then going to go away.
Why do they go away next?
Because there are no stable states at 58% of frictional packets.
And according to Marcus, they're going to move off and to get themselves out of contact with each other.
Sure. Okay.
Did I explain
the issue? The
no,
issue is that he's
sitting at 58% and straining it. So I'm trying to understand how I understand that. But now I'm sitting at 58% and I'm straining it. And what I see from Sri's results is that as a function of strain, my contact network is changing.
By straining it, he's doing pure shear, so that it's not changing the roll.
Yeah, correct.
Simple shear.
But you're not changing the roll.
It's still not changing. It doesn't matter. Still.
Simple shear would change.
No.
Simple volume preserving shear.
Both volumes.
That's how I think of a simple shear.
Right. Okay. Now, so, but what we're doing is simple shear.
Pure shear.
But the point is that he put in some energy. He applied a perturbation. He put in some energy. Force chains lit up. And his force chains slowly decay.
There's
no stable state there.
Okay, so there are two things I...
He said that there's no stable states there. There's unstable modes.
No. So what I am saying is, as you continue to strain, you develop structure that is stable. The structure is stable in the sense of it doesn't go away, right? It remains. And then you can ask, what does that correspond to in terms of mechanical behavior, which is what I did later on. Now, what you seem to be describing is if you were to compress and if you were to sort of follow the procedure of sort of seeking the local energy minimum, you are going to go away from whatever structure you generate if you are compressed isotropically.
Now, so, saying, what's the fundamental difference with isotropic compression? There's a normal isotropic compression, say done in the late 90s. You would compress, and you would form a structure, like an incipient jam structure. You would form that at 58%, and then it doesn't fully jam until 64%. What I'm saying is, what is different about the incipient structure that occurs through isotropic compression at 58% and what you're talking about? Do you see what I'm saying?
No, so...
There's an incipient structure at 58% that's formed, and it only slightly changes as you go higher and higher.
I would
have to look at and understand exactly what those properties of the incipient structure you form are. I don't know offhand what the difference is, but I'm not claiming any difference. I'm claiming this is what happens when you do straining, when you do shearing, and I'm trying to present an analysis of what is happening. Yeah, so whether there is a possibility of doing the equivalent of what I presented in all its details by isotropic compression, I'm skeptical, but I'm not going to take a position on it.
No, let Emmanuel answer.
So I just want you to say, I like the idea that, because I'm not sure I understand what you want to say with this. So I like the idea that, as far as I understood, you want to say that this is something similar to what friction could do. But before really making this, saying this is not a coincidence, the fact that I would like
but
to
what
see.
Can you say begin from the beginning again? I didn't hear.
So I was saying that I like the idea, and it could be that there is something deeper into that. But I would like to see what's the dependence on the system size, because I'm wondering whether what you're seeing here is the fact that with this system size, and you get a percolation at this volume fraction, and more or less things are percolating around this volume fraction. So when you put friction, they got stuck at that volume fraction, and this is the coincidence that you're seeing, or there is more to that.
Okay, we haven't done finite size analysis, so I can't answer that question.
But
with,
you think
with,
that there is more than
but,
that?
But I think there is more to it, because, do I understand why there is more to it? No.
Because my question,
I'm trying to understand.
I'm thinking that you are kind of exploring the dependence of maybe yield strain on the rate at which you are deforming your system.
So the sort of
this is
intuitive explanation, which is not mine, mm-hmm. of what happens above 58% is that you have the answer. I mean, this is sort of old stuff, which, like I said, other people know better here, that you have the onset of dilatancy, right? But in the absence of the possibility to expand, you are generating configurations that jam up, right? Except in the absence of friction, they really don't have all they need in order to be stable mechanically. But friction then will supply that additional stabilization that you need. But the geometry that you need in order to be stable and at these densities seems to simply come from shear, and that's what I'm trying to say.
So but there must be a dependence on the shear rate, which is a bit along the line, I think, of what Carl was saying at the beginning, that is you have some interest intrinsic timescale that is set by the resolution at which you do your minimization of the energy for something.
I mean, so if I were to be looking at frictionless real grains, yes, there will be a dependence on you know, but then I'm not denying the possibility that there will, I do think that there will be some dependence on the strain rate, but
Can I turn that argument around about system size, which is the bigger you make your system size, the longer it will be to really relax your system to zero energy. And so as system size grows, this effect might actually become more rather than less important.
Yes, this is what I think. But I would like to see it. I think in the sense that
as system size
as it
gets
grows,
larger,
if you really have to globally relax,
right,
then as your system size grows, the characteristic relaxation time grows as well.
Yeah.
The time you have to wait to make Corey happy.
Yeah.
To grow how?
It works.
Actually, it's not obvious that it should grow.
No, I'm just saying, if you know that the energy is, it can be zero,
yeah,
then you might as well try to prove that it is.
Well, but I mean, it may be a moot
point.
But
there are so many states
at
zero energy, right?
Let me just be clear about this point. In the 20 slides I have here, I don't have the evidence for you. but the energy does go to zero at lower at the lower end of this density range.
At the lower end, yes. At the lower end, yes. Not at the
okay.
No, no, but that proves that whatever procedure we're using is removing the energy. Sorry?
I think that's sort of what you're talking
about. It hasn't done it.
Like a bigger system, it's got more sort of jammed or involved with rigid regions, and the relaxation gets slower. So it's not as if it's a kind of a glass problem.
So let's say that if you shear the system at a certain shear rate,
sure. There
is a value of the yield stress that you will measure. Mm-hmm. And then if you go beyond that stress, then you will be able to
reorganize your system. But in these systems, in the shear jamming systems, shearing creates the solid. Shearing doesn't break it.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So
that's,
well,
but
shear rate. So I think,
but
yeah, this
rate,
is...
But the rate can change the thing at which you... And this is...
I'm saying it does
so I guess
both.
I think that's a good way to...
I'm saying it does both in these cases. It's shearing, it's creating these structures. And of course, they'll break it at some point. But the experiments of Bob's that we have looked at, the shearing creates the structures.
Right. But according to the O'Hearn concept that you can shear it, and in fact you can jam it for a while, but then it will relax. It's going to undergo.
If there's no friction,
but this is friction.
Strain,
that's
right.
I know.
Yeah. Relaxation, but then find its lowest energy.
But you could rephrase the question to ask, how much friction would it take
as
an alternate system size to stabilize the system?
Well, or, I don't understand what is friction.
It's just a tangential force.
It's keeping the particles from slipping around, which they have to do.
In
your own words.
But Sri, we have talked about this. I think you need to look at the anisotropy of the network to see if there is any anisotropy, and then answer Paul's question then of this look similar to the isotropically created states.
There is anisotropy.
Let me not say anything about it because we haven't completed that analysis. But
one interesting comparison with step one is that you're looking at a completely different issue. So step one is looking at he's looking at 66, 67.
But that's a polydispersed system, so that was my.
I can tell.
Yeah, so maybe he can say what he's.
I was waiting for.
He might want to.
We are actually looking. We were looking closely in this regime.
At 63%?
No, that doesn't matter. The number depends on what it is.
I need to talk.
You're using
your slide. You cannot.
I want what is, okay. I was closing it up. But so what do you want me to do?
Just like leave it at that.
Whatever.
Which one?
The one.
That was one. Okay. So we were looking closely here.
But I disagree. Wait, if you give me the polydispersity number, I'll convert it.
Yeah, exactly. That's
no, but it's not there. It's higher.
So another polydispersity just moves the number. Mm-hmm. I'm talking qualitatively.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's important whether it's 63 or whether it's 65.
Okay, then I can sit down again.
No. What I'm saying is, and we should sit down it matters whether you're above this nominal value of 64%, which is what you get if you sort of create very disordered systems, and whether you're shear jamming in states above 64%. But that's the thing that Stefan and I need to discuss, is that I think what he does if he quasi-statically shears is he's actually looking at the J line in Sri's language, and it's not 64 and below, it's 64 and above. And so it's this huge distinction.
No.
Okay,
that's not right. So.
All right, I think you probably want to cut the formal discussion or whatever, informal discussion out, and then it can become even more informal.
Right? No, the point is either I give my talk and have my say on Thursday, or we continue now. But you are talking now about things which cannot be followed by the rest of the audience.
Exactly. Yeah, that's why I'm saying.
Just like your main point that you wanted to make.
So present your view on your work.
So I go through his talk.
Then.
Yes. Okay, agreed.
Agreed.
Shear jamming and so on. Now, here are what?
I don't know.
Here are one or two things where we did things differently. So we do molecular dynamics. Mm-hmm. We don't do energy minimization, so our particles can lose their forces and they can relax if they want, and if we give them enough time. So if we compress too fast, we get a qualitatively different answer than if we compress too slow. So everything what we did was we did it 10 times slower, and if that was not satisfactory, we did it 10 times slower again. Okay, so that is about the rate dependence. Mm-hmm. Now, internal analyze. Okay, we did frictionless in order to answer the question whether Bob's shear jamming can be found in a frictionless system. The answer is yes. Okay, we had to search for it. I mean, it doesn't come by nothing.
So they are rare states, if you want to say that. You have to search for it because the states are rare?
No, the regime where you find it is finite but narrow.
Okay.
Without friction. That's what I say. With friction, it's the range more or less. We see the same numbers as you do. Now, everything what I said, what you said, was monodisperse?
Monodisperse, yeah. No friction.
Okay. And monodisperse gives you an isotropic jamming point of 0.64. Polydisperse, plus minus 0.01.
Well,
plus minus, 0.005.
I would say that it can give you a range of jamming densities, except monodisperse is not a good system to sort of be very unambiguous about it, so it's better to look at
the polydisperse. That's what you said. You said the real stable packings which you found were around 0.64 and above.
Yeah, but we do one thing, right? I mean,
we have a procedure.
Right, yeah.
Okay. So I confirm 0.64, the magic number of random close packing. That's also what we find with monodisperse frictionless field. But we didn't want to do monodisperse frictionless spheres because then everything what we do afterwards would be partly crystallization and partly something else. Okay, so now, having accepted that fact, we go immediately to a polydisperse, and the polydispersity is 1 to 3 homogeneous, and that means the jamming point, the isotropic jamming point, moves up by 0.02. Okay, and that's it. If you do 1 to 5, you move up by 0.025, so you just have a different jamming point. You move your axis a little bit. Qualitatively, nothing changes. Quantitatively, it's only a small shift. Now, the bad news is the range, the interesting range in frictionless jammings is 0.02. Okay, so it looks like an enormous change, but I don't think it is.
But are the states very different from isotropically jammed states?
Yes, sure. Okay, and how we get them, how they look like and what they do, that's, I cannot do that in a few minutes. Now, most of that what you showed, that is what I call, what I consider, or what could be, what was examined in the last 30 years by hard sphere simulations, kinetic theory type approaches and so on, that is all below jamming. And then you have entropy and entropical and structural features which are explored already, which are consistent with that what you show. I also agree with Corey, your number of contacts is protocol dependent, highly protocol dependent. That makes it rate dependent. And I don't think it's system size dependent, but that's a discussion which we have anyway. Okay, but it may and depend on where you are. System size and rate are related. For some features, they are not. Because if you are sure that you do everything slow enough, then maybe system size dependence and rate dependence decouple. Okay, so I signed everything what you say, but the results which you show that below jamming, there's a density regime that given this procedure, you find qualitatively different features, and below, it's just a normal fluid. Here, it's an interesting fluid, or a glass, and above it's jammed. And you were nicely exploring this with the few features which I didn't know, and the G of R and so on, that is known since long. So there is something. Since it's now qualitatively different, maybe this is associated with shear jamming. There I'm not convinced, but with friction you change the system, and then you really have to do the system size dependence of your lower point. You have to do the protocol dependence of your lower point, because actually our results say protocol is everything. I can explain everything by the protocol, and that makes it, you have to try a few different protocols and see whether that confirms. Otherwise, you are a little bit on weak feet. Is that the English?
Footing.
No.
Footing.
Standing on sand. That is
the first slide.
Okay.
on that note, I think we need to make it over because I think there's another workshop in here, but we'll continue.